May it please the board, this is Les Middleton, this is an item for the house.
May it please the court, I'm Les Middleton of the Bexar County Bar. This case is before the court on certified questions from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. I will begin by telling the court first what the certified questions are, identify the statutes and constitutional provisions that the court must consider. I will briefly outline my argument and then discuss it with the court. The certified questions from the Fifth Circuit are first, does the discovery rule apply to the Texas statute of limitations regarding wrongful death and survival actions? And secondly, if it does not, because it is an absolute statute, does that statute as applied to plaintiffs deprive them of access to the courts in violation of the open courts provision of the Constitution of the State of Texas, Article 1, Section 13? Are they denied remedies as well as reasonable access to the courts? We will show in our argument that the statute of limitations, that is Section 16.003 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, is one statute. It has two sections. Both sections say that a cause of action must be instituted within 2 years from the time it accrues. However, the legislature, as we will show from 1879, incorporated a provision in Section B which says that the cause of action accrues at the time of death. It is the position of the plaintiffs that the intent, the historical, specific intent of the legislature was to set the earliest time, not the latest, but the earliest time that a cause of action may be instituted. We will show that the legislature has left to the judiciary to determine the latest date. And what must be decided by this court in this case is truly the meaning of the word accrual or accrues. What is it that must be established in order for the cause of action to accrue, although courts have talked about it for over 75 years? And we have talked about it in discovery rule cases since 1967. It is our contention, and we will show that there has been some loose language used so that there is some confusion as to what it is that must be discovered. The accrual of a cause of action, we will show, is in effect a mature right to sue, that certain things must be established before the cause of action accrues. Since 1912 at least, this court has stated that a cause of action does not accrue for damages unless the plaintiff knows of the fact that it has been damaged. Moreover, Texas public policy is to protect individual liberties, to protect the interests of the family, to provide remedies. And we will show that the policy of the state of Texas, the public policy of the state, is furthered by applying a discovery rule, if you will, concept to the wrongful death statute of limitations.
Right at the outset, didn't this court unanimously recognizing the Medical Malpractice and Liability Improvement Act of 1975, that the legislature could write a statute in a way that cut off the discovery?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a legislative intent specifically there. Speaking of Morrison against Chan, perhaps. In Morrison against Chan, this court did say that the legislature could intend to do that. And it did because of...
Don't we have rather plain words of this statute?
I beg your pardon?
Don't we have a rather plain word of this statute?
Yes, I will address that, Your Honor. I don't think that this court can determine public policy merely by reading a few words out of context. And this court has, for many years, in the cases that we have cited, explained that in assigning meaning to a statute, one must look to the entire statute and determine what the intent of the legislature was and the purpose for the statute. This court has already said in 1893 that the purpose of that language in this statute, that's the Ham against Mexican Railway Company, was to set the earliest date. Now that was exactly 14 years after the first statute of limitation was enacted. That was 1879. 2 years later, that same language was reincorporated. There is nothing in the legislative history of this statute to show that there was any intent to provide the latest date, because in DeHam, the Supreme Court stated that since an injury could occur more than 2 years prior to the date of death, the date of death is the time, the earliest time that the statute could begin to run. The Nevada Supreme Court recently in Pope against Gray, which we have cited in our brief in just this year, had a similar situation there. There was a prior case in 1984 where they held that it was the intent of the legislature as to the word accrual to fix the date of death as the time when the cause of action accrued. There was the same hiatus that we have here, and the Supreme Court of Nevada said, we did not mean to say that that was the latest time, that was the earliest time. And I think
all of our increasing application of the discovery rule seems to me has been in an attempt to do the right thing, to realize that it's very hard when you're in the course of life to be put on knowledge that something has happened that may give rise to a cause of action. In the pre-legislative days on medical malpractice, somebody leaves scissors in your stomach, you may not feel that for 3 years. A lawyer commits malpractice in Willis versus Maverick. We don't expect a party to drop their everyday life just after they've been to a lawyer and go hire another lawyer to make a search and investigation of everything that lawyer did. We wait till something happens that reasonably puts them on notice. But isn't something as dramatic and final as a death something that puts you on notice that if you want to look into the cause, I mean, if you're thinking about, if there's a possibility that anyone is at fault for that, you're put on notice that it has happened.
I think that the Ninth Circuit has spoken to this in the swine flu cases. I know the court has these briefs from the Fifth Circuit in front of it. I don't know if it was briefed in the Supreme Court briefs. The Fifth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and the Third Circuit in certain cases have held that there is no duty to investigate, to make an independent investigation. That would be an engrafting of an exception or an additional burden to plaintiffs if the court here in Texas would require that. All that has ever been required is that a plaintiff must act either upon actual knowledge or legal notice. Now, certainly, when someone has a pain in his stomach, he is put on notice. I would say that when Gaddis had the pain in the stomach and went to the doctor to try to find out what was wrong, he was on notice that something was wrong. The fact that there is the death of a child, however, does not put one on notice that there is someone out there in the world who has legally wronged you. And it has always been only when you have actual knowledge or legal notice that there is such a cause of action. Now,
As a policy matter, if the discovery rule applied in death cases, why wouldn't that make for a great many more claims simply because over the passage of time we know more about what causes death and what should have been done?
Well, in a free society and our society in Texas being a free one and interested in protecting human life and protecting the family, there may be more claims. Obviously, there would be more claims. Those that are now barred by limitation would exist. So that is true. However, there is ample historical policy for this. The not necessarily in our state, but nationally. Certainly the Agent Orange victims were protected and not precluded. They were precluded by the government contractor defense, but not limitation. Hiroshima victims, as well as victims of atomic bomb testing in the United States, have been protected. The asbestos victims have been protected. So the fact that someone dies is not a reason to treat one differently than when someone is injured. And I can tell the court without hesitation that it would be an invidious discrimination, I believe, for it to take the position that a discovery rule applies if one's child is injured, but does not apply if one's child is killed.
What's the heightened scrutiny classification? Why, you say an invidious discrimination.
Certainly.
Which I think to me means that you're saying there's some kind of constitutional protection there.
Certainly there is.
For survivors or...
Yes. There are two cases that we have cited, there are a number of cases that we have cited that haven't been addressed by opposing counsel. Two of the most important ones are Landers against B.F. Goodrich, which established that there are two individual causes of action, one for wrongful death and one for survival, and that both of them are in effect based upon common law principles. Because, you know, our Wrongful Death Act is merely an enabling statute. I think this was amply showed in the Sanchez and Schindler case, and it is truly an enabling act. It is the court that puts the meat and substance on the bones of what rights individuals in our society in the state of Texas have. Now, in Vassalo, with a very long name in Holland at the end of it that we cite, that was a case in 1961, where this court held that the survivors, that is, the beneficiaries' rights to bring a wrongful death action are identical to those of the decedent had he not been killed, had he survived. In that case, there was a maritime injury. Mr. Vassalo was killed at sea. There was no Death on the High Seas Act at that time, and so there was a suit brought in Texas under the Texas Wrongful Death Act. Under the applicable maritime law, he was protected by comparative negligence at that time, and under Texas law, the Wrongful Death Act had the absolute bar of contributory negligence. This court held, and we have elaborated it in all of our briefs, that the rights of the survivors, beneficiaries, were his rights. They were entitled to comparative negligence as a standard for the right to recover. That case stands for the proposition that a beneficiary under the Wrongful Death Act has the same detriment, if you will, and the same benefits as one had he lived. If the court is to say that had the Sloan or Moreno children lived, that they would have been entitled to the discovery rule, but because they died, their parents would not, I believe would be an invidious discrimination. I believe that it would prevent their parents from having reasonable access to the courts, and under the open courts provision, the cases that, for example, Hines against the city of Port Arthur, where one had to report a defect to one of the commissioners, it was held that the access to the courts were being impaired, or that the access to the courts was impeded to the plaintiff. Certainly in Lucas versus the United States, recently decided by this court, the remedy was impaired. And I should think that it is that kind of a discrimination which this court, if it is an absolute statute, would have to address. We have already decided in our jurisprudence that the discovery rule is applicable to injury cases. Now, is there a reason to discriminate between...
I thought the discovery rule was still an exception. And it is still being adopted on a case-by-case basis by this court on a relatively slow basis. I mean, we've been doing it for 100 years now, and it's still the exception to the rule. It's not a rule that has this one exception that you say violates open courts.
Let me go back. The statute is one statute. Both sections as to when a cause of action accrues must, not may, with all due respect, but must be treated the same. We have used, as I can see that I may as well close my outline.
Sorry.
No, that is absolutely appropriate, John. I can say that what has happened is that we have used the word injury in an inappropriate way. In Gaddis against Smith, we said that where the injury was discovered, that is when the cause of action accrued. Now, that's wrong. Let's assume that the sponge is left in Gaddis, and Gaddis has physical pain and mental anguish. He's incurring medical bills to try to find out what's wrong with him. He's losing time from work. He's physically impaired. What is happening to him is that he is suffering damages recognized by the law of the state of Texas. He is suffering from a deprivation of a protected right. And when he discovers the cause in fact of that, the cause in fact, it is then that the cause of action accrues. What I want to cite to the court, and which we didn't cite, and I apologize to the court, because in beginning to study and prepare for oral argument, I realized that no one had addressed the question of what does accrue mean. And fortunately, we had the assistance of the amicus, and the amicus cited us to Zittle against Byrd, or Zedell against Byrd. And although I feel that the argument in that case about when a about legal injury or the legal injury rule is somewhat specious as it applies to personal injury cases, there the Austin Court of Appeals specifically said that a cause of action accrues at the earliest time that a plaintiff may bring his case. And that means that in this case, the earliest time that the plaintiff could sue would be at the time of death. Now, that is totally consistent. What the court has to do is re-examine what it means as to when a cause of action accrues. And I would commend to the court Kubrick against the United States. That is a case that we have cited in our briefs. In Kubrick, the United States Supreme Court had before it the issue of how the discovery rule is to apply to medical malpractice cases involving the Federal Tort Claims Act. The plaintiff said that the cause of action does not accrue until you discover all elements of the cause of action. The United States said, no, the cause of action accrues when you discover the cause in fact. Now, we're taking the conservative position in this case. We're saying minimally the cause of action accrues at the time that one discovers the cause in fact of a deprivation of a protected legal right or damages. That's all. This language about injury and, gee, death is an injury, is meaningless. Because merely because one dies or a child dies is no reason to suppose that there has been a legal wrong. To say so would be a requirement that a parent, when the child dies, must, within 2 years, consider every vendor with whom the party has come into contact, consider every plant that could expose that child to a toxic substance, and bring a lawsuit in order to protect their rights against everybody in society. And that's ludicrous, and that would not be sound public policy for the state. The much more reasonable policy is to require the plaintiff, the parent, merely to know when it is that there is harm. All of the cases, and I wish to cite the court to some cases, all of the cases speak about what is the knowledge of the plaintiff. One of the earliest cases is Port Arthur Milling Company against Beaumont Mills. That case is not cited to the court, and I will present it with the court's permission in a post-argument submission.
1 week.
Beg your pardon?
Can you do it in a week?
Yes. That, in that case, it was a conversion case. The court elaborated on what constitutes the accrual of a cause of action, in effect said you have to have all elements. The reason why the plaintiff did not have knowledge of the conversion was because of the conduct of the defendant. It was a fraud case. And the court said because of the fact that the plaintiff was prevented from knowing because of the defendant's fraud, the statute doesn't run. But the principle was not that the defendant did something wrong, but that the plaintiff didn't have knowledge. There's another case, Williams against Pure Oil, which is cited in the Weaver case, but they talk about Williams in the sense of it being in a personal injury case at the time of injury. There, a cause of action, according to the Commission of Appeals in 1935, exists when all of the elements of the cause of action are present, including knowledge of the relevant facts or the facts sufficient to establish a cause of action. We're merely saying that in this instance, if you don't know of the cause in fact, then you are not put on notice, or if there is not some notice in the public generally, then you have no, the cause of action does not accrue. Now I know that there will be some comment that, well, there ought to be a difference between wrongful death and injury. Because in an injury case, the person may be disabled, can't investigate his case, but the parents, well, they're able right away. For the court to buy that argument, it would have to engage in legislative fact findings, which I think are not before the court. You would have to presume that parents will not be grieving for their children any longer than a person would be incapacitated by the bodily injury that he might suffer. There is no law in this state that says that there is a tolling during a time of incapacity, and that's what prevents the cause of action from accruing in a personal injury case. There is absolutely no reason for there to be a difference as to when the cause of action accrues in a death case than in a personal injury case, unless this court finds that there is a specific legislative intent and purpose to limit this to an absolute two-year statute, and you would have to say that this court in 1893 was wrong in DeHam when it said that the court set the earliest date. I think that would be setting the clock truly back beyond 1893 in our jurisprudence if we did.
Now, I'm sure I understood, you do agree that if the legislature did intend to have an absolute period of 2 years, they could say so.
They could do that, and then the court is called upon to consider whether or not it violates the open courts provision.
And your position is that it does.
Absolutely, because in Morrison against Chan, number one, the holding was that Mrs. Gray learned of the hole in her body, I believe in September 1980. She was on notice at that time that the excess radiation had caused this problem. Now, in our case, there is, I believe, the kind of impossibility, I will go in the few moments I have left, to the argument in regard to open courts. Let's assume that we're talking about open courts, and recognizing that we have a recognizable common law right because the damages that one recovers for wrongful death, according to the Vassallo case, and certainly Sanchez, are common law and not statutorily created. Then the question is whether there is a reason to discriminate. Now, in Nagel against Nelson, this court said at page 12 that for purposes of appeal, the court must accept as true the allegations of impossibility, and the facts of the case are very simple, and I apologize for taking so long to get to them. The Moreno child became ill in January 1981. He was treated with Bayer's chewable children's aspirin, among other things. Got very, very sick, was taken to the emergency room of the hospital, I believe, in Seguin, and died. The Sloan child had almost the same complications in September of 1981, was likewise treated with Bayer children's chewable aspirin, had complications, and died. They contacted a lawyer, who I hope was competent in the way he handled the case, contacted an expert. That expert concluded that there was no professional medical negligence, said nothing about any connection between aspirin and the cause of death being Reye syndrome. Moreover, there was nothing said about whether any of the other medication that was given had any connection, whether any of the clothing that the child wore was toxic, whether the location that the child was living in was toxic. The reason I bring this up is that there's nothing to put the plaintiffs on notice that there was any toxic insult that injured the child. So they say that since they did not know until sometime in 1985 that there might be a connection between the ingestion of aspirin and Reye's syndrome, it was truly impossible for them to discover.
Was that connection known in the medical profession at that time?
But in the medical profession,
well,
I think that you're going to find doctors today, just like in the toxic shock and tampon cases, you're going to say that there's no connection between one and the other. But I think the aspirin industry knew, and if there was a fiduciary relationship between this defendant and the plaintiffs in the case, we might be able to claim fraudulent concealment. And that may be the basis of... I beg your pardon?
What's the fiduciary relationship?
I'm saying that if, for example, a doctor-patient relationship, if that which is fiduciary, you can claim...
Is that found to be fiduciary?
If I, as I suggest the courts have done, used the words loosely, I apologize. I cannot tell the court if that is fiduciary. It is certainly a relationship of trust, I believe, which I thought was fiduciary, but I think that it is an unimportant... element to our argument, because I'm merely saying that you don't have to have a fraudulent concealment case in order to invoke what we are attempting to invoke here in the way of the open course provision of the statute. But to answer your question, the aspirin industry knew, and I think it can be shown in trial that it knew. But there was nothing notorious. There was nothing that the plaintiffs knew, and there was no dissemination until I think 1986. When warnings were put on labels of aspirin products for children.
You haven't used this phrase, but I'm curious to know if you believe this discovery rule encompasses whether a plaintiff knew or should an exercise of ordinary care should have known.
Yes, and I believe that, I think you have knowledge in fact or constructive notice.
So you would say you would concede that the statute of limitations would begin to run at such time as a plaintiff either knew or should have exercised the ordinary care note.
I believe that the little Abner test, if the court will, would apply, and that is if any fool can plainly see that there was a connection, that the plaintiff is not going to be able to escape saying that he did not know. But there, in our case, and that is, as I believe Justice Kilgarland suggested in a concurring opinion in either, I guess it was Prusin, perhaps. No, he wrote it.
But this is a certified question. We don't need to really deal with the facts of this.
No, that's the point. That is a condition subsequent, not a condition preceding. The defendant perhaps could defeat a claim by saying that as a matter of fact, you knew or you should have known. The issue for this court is, does the discovery rule apply? Or if it doesn't, does the failure to apply it violate the open courts provision? Then the plaintiff in each case must show himself qualified, if you will, or must meet that condition subsequent test to establish that he did not know and he should not have known. But I sincerely believe that the court should not have to reach the constitutional question, because I believe that the court should reach the answer to the question simply as a matter of assigning meaning to the statute. This statute sets out rules, it applies to certain situations. As a matter of jurisprudential expertise, it is up to the court to fill in the gaps and to achieve a just result in each case, and it will do so by applying the principles that have been at work for 100 years to show that the cause of action does not accrue until the plaintiff does in fact know of the cause in fact, or should have known of the cause in fact, of the deprivation of his legal right or his damages. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark M. Donheiser, representing Mr. McCullough.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Donheiser and I represent Sterling Drug. much of Helen's argument went to what does accrue mean in this situation? It's right before the court in the statute. The cause of action accrues on the death of the injured person. The literal quote of the legislative language. It's clear, it's direct, it's unambiguous. Under the guise of statutory construction, you'd have this court ignore what the legislature said in absolute words. Legislative intent, as this court has repeatedly held in the cases cited in our brief, is to be gleaned from the wording of the statute itself and from no other source. The discovery rule is merely a method of construing the word accrual when it's used in a statute of limitation without a definition of when the prescriptive period begins to run. In situations such as the first subsection of section 16.003, where accrual is left undefined, the court must figure out what it means. And that's what the discovery rule is.
Would you go right to the heart of the matter and tell me how this case is any different from Nelson versus Cruzan, where the parent could not determine the disease of the child until the child was at least 3 years old?
Your Honor?
Well, in other words, in that case, it was impossible to discover. I don't know what the facts are in this case, but would you concede that that is applicable in, despite the statutory language, if, in fact, the open court provision applies?
Of course, inherent in Nelson v. Cruzan, although we're dealing with a different statute of limitations, is the finding that the statute was absolute, which I think, before we get to Nelson v. Cruzan or any of that analysis, we must assume that the statute is absolute.
Isn't this pretty absolute?
We just heard 30 minutes how it wasn't. But to me, yes. I think there is no question. We then get to Nelson v. Cruzan, and there are several important distinctions. If I'm going to jump right ahead to the open courts and get back to the rest if necessary. Mr. Mendelson has said, because this is a certified question, this court need not consider the facts of the case. I don't think either the application of the discovery rule or the constitutionality of the statute can be determined in a vacuum. Discovery rule application is a case-by-case application. It has not been, the court has never held that whenever accrual is undefined, we have the discovery rule. In fact, in Robinson v. Weaver, the court refused to apply it. For constitutional questions, the court never addresses those in the abstract. We have to see how it affects this claimant. So the facts are important.
Well, this is a certified question. It's kind of new to us, to be honest with you.
Your Honor,
one we've had, and
it creates all kinds of...
A recitation of the facts simply to set up the question, any more than that is necessary.
The Fifth Circuit felt it necessary to send some facts. In the record, I assume, are the debates over what should be sent to this court, and you'll see the debate over whether any facts should be sent at all. The Fifth Circuit did determine to send some brief summary of the facts, because it can't be determined in a vacuum. The first distinction, to get back to your question, Your Honor, and to get back to the open court, is time and time again, when applying open court, when determining an open court's challenge, the first step this court has laid out is that the claimant must establish a common law, a cause of action well established in the common law. Nelson v. Cruzan was a common law action. This is not a common law action. These are statutory actions. Now, at first blush, that may seem to be, so what? Why has this court put that in each of its decisions, even in situations such as Lucas, where it simply puts it in and then says, and of course the parties do not dispute that this is a common law cause of action, reiterates it because it's an essential part of the test, because the open court's provision in this context is a limitation on the legislature's power to curtail causes of action existing at common law that a person would have whether the legislature existed or not. Here, however, at common law, the Sloans and the Marinos would have no causes of action. Until these two statutes were passed, there was no cause of action for wrongful death, and the claims of the injured party died with him. The legislature, in passing this scheme, has not restricted rights. It has expanded them beyond, well beyond, what was ever recognized at common law. The complaint here is not an unreasonable restriction, it's that they haven't been expanded enough. It is the cases cited, Landers and Vassallo, that for the proposition that once the legislature has created these causes of action, well, we'll in determining them and in reaching rules of substance as to how to proceed, we'll treat these just like the common law torts that they mirror. It does not mean that these are common law causes of action. The legislature says there is a cause of action, period, to in derogation of the common law, to overrule the common law rule, and then leaves it to the court to say what the rules of comparative negligence and so forth are going to be. It doesn't say in the statute, so of course this court had to construe, and that's the holdings in Landers and Vassallo. But the legislature here, in derogation of the common law, went further than the common law ever allowed and gave new rights. No decision of this court has ever held that once the legislature gives a right, it cannot take it away or cannot put reasonable limitations on it. And that's exactly what we have here. Obviously, Section 16.03, subsection B, causes of action arising in death, could only refer to wrongful death in survival. There are no such other causes of action. The statute, I'm not 100% clear on this, but I think the court will check the statute, the original version of 16.03B was passed at the same time the first survival action was passed. The second point on the open courts challenge, distinguishing it from Nelson v. Cruzan, is should the discovery rule, assuming that we had an accrual statute here and not an absolute statute, should it apply to wrongful death actions anyway? And there is a significant difference between wrongful death and Nelson v. Cruzan. This court goes on a case-by-case basis, looking at the facts, the situation, to determine. And Robinson v. Weaver, this court set up a fairly complex series of factors to analyze. And in a subsequent Dallas Court of Appeals decision, Justice Robertson put that out in a formula, so to speak, as to what factors should be considered in determining the discovery rule. Factors in a death case weigh against application. And we're, before I get any further, we're not talking about a case where the fact of death is not discovered. Clearly a totally different situation. We're talking about a case where the fact of death is immediately known. What factors did this court look at in Robinson? It's a balancing, very similar to the open courts challenge, balancing the purpose of the statute versus the restriction. Looked at the availability of physical evidence, comparing Gaddis v. Smith and Hayes, where the physical evidence was going to continue on being the injured person, and if there's something left in somebody's stomach, you can cut it open and see. But in Robinson, there was an unavailability of physical evidence to prove the claim. Exact same situation you're going to run into in death cases. In this case, and specifically, we have a further problem of a non-prescription drug, no evidence no prescription given, no medical records showing, no receipts, no bottles showing aspirin was taken at all, or that it was my client's product. Now, that goes, obviously, to reasonableness, but it also goes to whether it should apply in this sort of situation. The availability...
You just told me a while ago we should go into the facts. Now you're saying, well, we don't have enough facts, and I agree with the latter.
Well, Your Honor, well, in determining whether the discovery rule should apply to this sort of action, take it as an example of the problems, just like in Robinson v. Weaver, the problems that will be inherent that aren't inherent in the cases where this court has applied the discovery rule, and that is no physical evidence left. So take those as merely examples. In Gaddison, Hayes, and Nelson v. Cruz, and the other cases where on a case-by-case basis this court has applied the discovery rule, it has been with extant physical evidence surviving past the limitations period. In Robinson, and in this case, we don't have that situation. Robinson's court was also concerned with the necessity of relying purely upon memories for essential facts, because memories fade with time. We're talking about deaths that occurred in 1981 now. Here, as in Robinson, memories are all that's left of crucial elements of this case. Whose product? Was it taken at all? Was it prescribed by a physician? We have cited to the record, the Fifth Circuit record at least, depending upon what portion has been sent up here, the summary judgment evidence on that, that there is none. Lastly, in Robinson, this court was concerned with whether the extent the whole case would turn on expert testimony concerning events in the distant past, frowning upon that as a factor. Here, last page, last substantive page of Appellant's brief before this court, they, obviously not having read Robinson, say this is just going to be an expert testimony case. Exactly the sort of situation that Robinson was concerned about. Robinson then balanced that against the purposes of the statute of limitations, which we all know the general purposes, but in a death case, there are other purposes. Purposes of the prompt resolution of the affairs of the deceased. Issues that aren't relevant for live plaintiffs. So in the balancing, a Robinson type of balancing, we have the same factors concerning the restriction on one hand, but more factors favoring the statute. So we would submit that there's no constitutional harm here because the discovery rule should not apply in any event to this case. Should not apply in general to death cases, but of course that's a fact by, case-by-case determination which the courts will have to go through. There's been a lot of talk about the distinction between facts of injury, damages, and there is a lot of loose language in the cases. Not, I'd say loose language guardedly, language used that applies to each of those individual cases that when taken out of context and applied to a different situation, we get clearly conflicting results. Both appellants and I have been able to pull portions of this court's decision in Hayes in support of our position that it's the fact of injury, the death, that is important. Well, they're able to pull out more general language that supports the cause of action view of the discovery rule. It's clearly not been directly addressed, no matter how, to be honest with the court, no matter how much either of us point to our cases and say, yes, it is clearly. Whether the, when we're looking at the discovery rule, whether it should apply to, basically, their position, discovery of a cause of action, or our view, discovery of the fact of injury, the fact of damages. We think that is the better rule and basically what has been applied by the courts. But in some situations, not by this court, but in some of the Court of Appeals decisions, there have been, in the medical context, situations where the courts have refused to distinguish between the two. Now, in medical cases, such as the Porter, which I think is the IUD case, where, as Chief Justice Phillips mentioned at the very beginning, the application of the discovery rule has been sort of a dance to achieve fairness. When you have someone with a stomach ache or other problems, to say that the first manifestation of the stomach ache could put them on notice may not in all circumstances be fair. And I think that's what the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals was struggling to get to in those cases relied upon by appellants. We don't have that situation here. We have the full extent of the injury, the full extent of the damages known immediately. 2 years, the legislature gave 2 years in which, as a general rule, to then bring whatever suit you want.
You indicated earlier that this is not a situation where there's any delay in learning about the death.
Your Honor, I don't remember the exact number of days for each, but I think it's safe to say that the fact of death and the immediate cause were both known, and it's undisputed, within 2 weeks. And I think
would it make a difference in construing this statute, as you say it must be construed, if the potential claimants did not learn immediately of the death?
Your Honor, there is a Utah Supreme Court case, which is the only one I found, in which they addressed
a no knowledge of the fact of death case. A runaway who disappeared, was killed, and no one knew about it until many years later. That is a completely different situation. We would submit has no application here, because that is a different situation. I would say under the literal language of the statute, though, to answer your question, it would be barred. It may have difference, however, on the open courts analysis if you could get past the requirement of a common law cause of action.
Your analysis is that Utah case would be barred by the same construction you're urging on the court in this case.
Yes, sir.
Even if the parents had discovered the death for 2 years, they couldn't do anything about it.
Yes.
Are you saying the cause of death is known within 2 weeks? Is that the cause of death being Uriah's syndrome,
yes,
or the
sir.
Cause of death is the causal connection between the aspirin and the Uriah's syndrome?
No, Your Honor, the Uriah's syndrome. There is.
So they knew about what actually caused the death.
Yes, sir.
But they didn't know what was the underlying cause of that trauma or whatever that produced the final cause of death.
Your Honor, we keep getting back into this problem of what are we to answer in a certified question. I haven't even addressed the problems of federal versus state summary judgment evidence standards. The problem here is, Your Honor, and at least one of the four plaintiffs never even said they didn't know. We don't know other than pleadings. There's just no evidence on it. Now, Mr. Mendelson said, in quoting Nelson v. Cruzan, that of course must accept as true. Of course, the federal courts have a different summary judgment standard. In the Celotex case, if I had more time, I'd ask this court to reconsider their summary judgment standard, but that's not what we're here for. That's going to have to be decided in the Fifth Circuit. Whether this court should assume, I can't answer that because the standards are different, whether they knew or not. But the allegations clearly are that they did not know. Also, the summary judgment evidence, as long as I'm getting on that a little bit, two of the plaintiffs made no investigation. That is the summary judgment evidence. Think no if the test is going to be a reasonable investigation, then no investigation does not meet that standard. We have...
When should a person know that they ought to investigate?
In a death, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
I think...
Let's say a Reye syndrome death.
Your Honor?
Right after the funeral? Or when somebody comes to them and gives them information that raises some suspicion? When?
Your Honor, death is the most serious injury. If there is...
I think no one would agree with you on that.
If there is going to be a suit, a cause of action, accusations of wrongdoing, when the ultimate injury occurs, when the ultimate damage occurs, then yes, no, you should be put on notice that if anybody is going to be blamed for that, that's when it's going to start. A rumble in your tummy, as in the Quarter case, no. But death, yes. We have a clear indication, and it's not...
Is that really our decision to make?
Pardon?
But it's your first intention that that's not our decision to make.
Well, Your Honor, the two do begin to blend, at least in our view, because if we get, we clearly, as I think a lot of the court seems to be indicating, agree that the statute is clear, we then have to get to the open courts challenge. And part of that, we submit, is whether the discovery rule would even apply to this case. Because the constitutional challenge fails if, absent the statutory bar of Section 16.003B to the application of the discovery rule, absent that language, discovery rule wouldn't apply anyway. So if there is no discovery rule, then the constitutional challenge fails. They're not harmed, just as the parents in Sachs v. however we pronounce that, but
bottom.
Thank you, Your Honor. We're not harmed. If there is no harm, we don't even have to do the balancing. And so if the discovery rule would not or should not apply, the constitutional challenge fails. In the briefs, there is quite a bit of, and perhaps given the way the argument has gone, too much attention paid to foreign authorities, but I would just like to point out that of all the authorities from foreign jurisdictions cited in our briefs, one state seems to agree with the appellant's position, and that's the Alaska Supreme Court, taking exactly the position of their brief. Read the opinion and read the brief. They're very much in agreement. Every other court that has addressed this has either addressed...
How about the Nevada case?
Pardon?
How about the Nevada case?
It's an accrual statute, if I may use that language, Your Honor, where the statute says accrues, or some such language, leaving the Nevada Supreme Court to determine what that means, as are the other cases. Some of the cases cited, which are accrual statutes and apply the discovery rule, make this very distinction and say, well, we're free to do this. Well, we're going to disagree with the Minnesota court because they weren't free to do it. Their legislature had spoken. There are a few problem cases. Illinois seems to be in a total state of confusion. We have conflicting Court of Appeals decisions. We have the federal court decision out of Alabama where, for state law purposes, they hold it absolute, but then hold that the discovery rule, as it applies to the federal cause of action, is a tolling matter, not a question of the accrual of the statute of limitations. But each decision cited, each state cited in both of our briefs is either an accrual state or agrees with our analysis. The question before about the invidious
distinction. Chief Justice Phillips' question about the heightened scrutiny not been addressed under Texas law, but under the federal Constitution, the First Circuit in the Caddo case, which is cited in our brief, has discussed it at length, said there is no heightened scrutiny for not living versus dead, but living versus statutory representatives, and a rational basis is what's needed, rejected the U.S. constitutional grounds, challenges on that ground. There's also the Johnson v. Coppers case out of the Northern District of Ohio addressing the federal constitutional challenges, rejecting those on similar grounds, that it isn't a heightened scrutiny test, it is a rational basis, and that the very factors which we have cited in our brief for distinguishing between fatal and non-fatal injuries, claims arising out of fatal and non-fatal injuries, more than give a rational basis. If there are no further questions, I'll give the time back to the court.
We appreciate that.
May it please the court, Mr. Randall C. Jackson, the member of the appellant.
May it please the court. The central theme of the appellant's argument is that the man that does not know what caused his injury is as helpless to bring a lawsuit as the man who doesn't know he was injured. If there can be said to be a theme to the appellee's argument, it is that it doesn't matter when the man learns of his accrual of his cause of action. If he knew of his injury, he can't state it irrespective of when he learned what hurt him. We feel that is naturally an indefensible position. In 1879, this court said that the statute, the cause of action for wrongful death, accrues at death. The purpose of that was to prevent the statute from running or from being shortened before the victim died. This court said in 1893, the reason of the provision is obvious. Since no cause of action could be brought by the relatives of the injured person until death had ensued, and since a great length of time might elapse between the injury and the death, it was reasonable that the time of the death should be taken as the point from which limitations should begin to run. In Pope v. Gray, the Nevada court, as Chief Justice Phillips pointed out, found itself in an identical situation, but this time it was of its own making. In 1984, in a case called Gilloon, that court had to say, in a case in which the defendant claimed that the statute had run from date of injury, the court said, no, 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 not from date of injury. That would lead to an absurdity that runs from date of death. It created the same problem for the state of Nevada as our legislature unintentionally did in 1879. And last year, the Nevada Supreme Court had to correct itself and say, no, what we meant to say was, that fixes the earliest date, not the latest date. We submit that where a statute is open to two reasonable constructions, and where it concerns a remedial statute, such as the Wrongful Death Act, the appellants are entitled to the benefit of the doubt. We feel we have raised a doubt and that there is a doubt. There have been policy questions from Justice Heck regarding the appropriateness of discovery rule relief in the first place. I'd like to reassure the court that we are not going to open the floodgates of litigation by applying the discovery rule. In the first place, a wrongful death cause of action is driven. That means that if the statute ran as to the victim before he died, it ran to the survivor. That is going to eliminate a tremendous, tremendous class of potential claims. Sterling has pointed out the incredible proof problem.
If it ran to the victim before he died, it runs to the survivor.
Correct.
Can't they sue for his death after he dies? That was my argument.
Not if his, if he was time barred on his personal injury before he died. If he was hurt 3 years before and if he knew what killed him, and if he waits 3 years to die, if he knew what injured him when he was hurt, and 3 years later he dies, his survivors can't bring suit because he knew what killed, what hurt him. His cause of action ran, and their cause of action is derivative.
They can't bring suit for wrongful death, and they can't bring suit for survival.
Texas doesn't make a distinction. We are a unique state in that respect because our statute says injuries resulting in death, survival or wrongful death, makes no difference. Unlike all of the out-of-state authorities cited by Sterling Drug, in which those courts were able to split the baby because they had two statutes. And if the court will note, the vast majority of those courts gave the plaintiffs relief by tolling the statute during their ignorance of facts as to the survival action. They could not do so, or did not feel that they could do so, or did not need to do so.
If the injured person doesn't know, then we can toll here too.
Right. And our children became violently ill and died in a matter of moments, in a matter of hours, from Ryan syndrome caused by asthma. They didn't know. They're not time barred. That's not our case. I'm simply pointing out to the court that it does not raise the insurmountable problems of floodgates of litigation or a slippery slope that it appears to. In the second place, there's the proof problem alluded to by Sterling Drug. Sterling is concerned that people are all of a sudden going to start digging up dead bodies, as they pointed out, unearthing claims with tongue-in-cheek. There's going to be a proof problem here. If you can't prove your case, you can't win your lawsuit. We now have Rule 13 and Chapter 9 of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code. That's going to be a problem. Regarding facts, Sterling says we don't have enough facts to prove our case. We didn't go far enough into discovery for Sterling to know what facts we've got. And regarding our proof of causation, that relies on statistical proof and the virtually invariant correlation between aspirin and Reye syndrome. This court inquired before about the level of scrutiny that should be invoked in the discovery rule analysis and in open courts and the constitutional claims. That forces me to clear up a vast uncertainty which has been created by Sterling. Tolling provisions, discovery rules, and constitutional preclusion of limitation bars are three separate concepts. This court found in the Article 1, Section 13 cases that it couldn't use a discovery rule because the legislature said it doesn't exist. Didn't use discovery principles. It used impossibility and balancing principles, and it said reasonable time, not tolling. It said reasonable time, not from accrual, because it couldn't say when it accrued. In this case, this court is free to say it accrued upon knowledge, because the statute says the earliest, not the latest. Now, turning into our open courts argument, turning into this analysis, Sterling has claimed, and there has been some question, that because facially, superficially, ostensibly, a wrongful death cause of action is statutory, that open courts is not available. I think it is a misnomer. We believe it is a misnomer to say that a wrongful death cause of action is a statutory cause of action. The wrongful death statute was passed on the heels of Lord Campbell's Act in 1860. And in Texas, unlike other states, it imports no substance other than to say who can sue. Our Constitution does the same thing. We have a constitutional cause of action for death. We have a
what
non... Pardon?
What
Article 16, Section 26, punitive damages for wrongful death, an ancient statutory provision. That's two. We have a third, the non-abatement survival statute. Does that make survival a statutory cause of action? No. It makes it survival. Does it make the cause of action for punitive damages a constitutional cause of action? No. Nor is the wrongful death a wrongful death lawsuit based upon a statutory cause of action. It's an enabling provision. Look at 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, the Federal Civil Rights Statute. It looks to common law. So does the Wrongful Death Act. We look only to common law. Okay, you file a wrongful death case. What do you bring under your wrongful death case? You bring common law negligence causes of action, common law products liability causes of action, etc. Those aren't statutory. This court can reach those questions under open courts analysis. The purpose
was there no statute of limitations prior to the, I think the baby can get in 1879.
It was common law. It was probably, although I will research it for this court, it was probably the residuary English common law four-year statute.
So the whole change being post-Constitution from four years to 2 years start some possible open court, at least may call into question the open court balancing of LeBohm or Sachs, depending on which balance you prefer.
Exactly. And there was, under the old common law, the law was encumbered with a tremendous number of exceptions and inclusions and possibilities, like doctrines of laches, stale demands, a myriad of estoppel claims. So that very early statute of limitations analysis is not all that applicable in this action. But the second prong of our open courts analysis is to balance the deprivation of the right against the purposes and bases of the statute. The purpose and basis of the statute was to provide plaintiffs a reasonable time to discover and bring their causes of action. Here, there is an unreasonable time. The other purpose and basis was to provide defendants with some measure of repose at some point in time. We agree they're entitled to it, but we do not agree that they are entitled to it where the facts which give rise to the claims of their having caused injuries are concealed, are not available to the public, just as in the swine flu litigation, just as in the recent federal litigation regarding atomic testing in Utah, just in the Agent Orange litigation, with respect to which the plaintiffs prevailed on the statute of limitations issue, only to lose on the Ferries Doctrine.
But the two issues are different, are they not? The discovery and concealment are two different issues.
Yes.
You have the discovery rule not apply, and the plaintiff still be protected by the concealment issue.
Yes, but because it goes to the jury to inquire whether or not the plaintiffs knew or should have known and brought their action in a timely manner, it becomes evidentiary and becomes relevant to that extent. We cannot make a fraudulent concealment claim here because there was no relationship of trust between Sterling Drug and the dead children. Otherwise, I assure you, based upon the facts of what the aspirin industry has done since they discovered Reye syndrome connections in 1957, we'd have sworn that out. We could not do so.
57?
57. Thus, when we balance the purposes and bases of statutes of limitations in general against the deprivation to these plaintiffs, we find that under the Sachs v. Vogler test carried forward to Lucas, it's arbitrary and it's unreasonable. It's unreasonable because the plaintiffs have not had a reasonable time. based upon the facts which must be presumed as true and which a federal district judge found that these people had no obligation to, had no reason to have discovered the cause of their children's deaths. It's arbitrary because it establishes a distinction which may or may not be constitutionally invidious under equal protection grounds between persons who are injured so badly that they die and those who are merely wounded. I submit that this
court... You think there's no ration? Do you have any grounds for applying heightened scrutiny to that?
Heightened scrutiny to the extent that the right to bring a cause of action in the state of Texas is a fundamental right under open courts analysis. To the extent that one has a right to bring a wrongful death action for punitive damages under the Constitution, yes, I do. And we do.
There's nothing about the classification. But you say there's a fundamental interest involved in the Texas Constitution, it would not be under the federal Constitution.
Under the Texas Constitution only, not under the federal Constitution. But we submit that based upon these analyses, the heightened scrutiny comes in when you're depriving the plaintiffs of a fundamental right. The test under Sachs for applying the open courts is a simple rational relationship balancing test. Is the purpose...
And then you drag that, you take... What you'll do is take Article 1, Section 13, pull that into Article 1, Section 3, and make every...
We're not trying to do it. And I respectfully submit, Your Honor, that it's the reverse. We want to import, if this court wishes to do so, wishes to announce, to analyze the interrelationship of those two statutes. What is the effect of an invidious distinction where it serves to deprive a litigant of a fundamental constitutional right?
You reject the idea of personal liberty rights, which has been the touchstone for the touchstone of fundamental interest under the federal constitution, and would make some broader concept for under our state constitution
that is
mentioned in some portion of the Bill of Rights or something.
To some extent, well, we're not advocating that there's a state penumbra doctrine. However, there is a state right to privacy under the Constitution. This court has found.
Which does not necessarily make it a fundamental interest.
Does not make it a fundamental interest.
Necessary.
This court has said that the right of access to the courts is perhaps the fundamental interest.
Can you give me a cite on that?
I'll get it for you. I certainly can.
I'd like to.
It's in my brief.
You've
I apologize.
Asked for a week, I believe.
1 week.
A week to respond, if you desire.
To conclude, we respectfully submit that the first question be answered in the affirmative. In the event it cannot be, we request the second be answered in the affirmative.
That concludes the oral arguments in these cases. All three cases are presented on briefs and oral arguments. Marshall will please adjourn the court.
Oh, yes.